This is Science Moab, a show exploring the science happening in Southeast Utah and the Colorado Plateau. I'm Peggy Hodgkins, and today we are talking about the ecology of the Western U.S. shrubland systems. This includes the ecology of restoration, grazing, and livestock-wildlife plant interactions. Today we are speaking with Kari Veblen, Utah State University Professor of Rangeland Ecology. The Veblen Lab at USU includes a diverse group of field-based ecologists that work on both public and private lands that are managed for both wildlife conservation and sustainable livestock production. The goal of the science is to be able to provide information on sustainable management of rangeland systems. We begin with Kari describing what we mean by rangelands.
So when I think of rangelands, I think of these big, wide open spaces, usually these places that don't have any people around. And by definition, a rangeland is going to be an area that is not suited for any sort of intensive agriculture. And then the other part of a rangeland is that it's going to be inhabited by these large free roaming animals. So people often think of cattle automatically, but the other large free ranging animals on the landscape are going to be these large mammalian herbivores. Like on the Colorado Plateau, it may be elk or deer, or if we're thinking about African savannas, it might be something like elephants and zebras.
Within rangelands, you have worked both, well, with a lot of restoration following, say, domesticated grazing and stuff like that. I know you worked on that and started working on it in Africa, which is cool. What type of projects are you looking at in terms of rangeland ecology right now in the Western U.S.?
One of my areas of research is looking at rangeland restoration. So this is areas where maybe due to previous management or due to drought, the condition of the rangeland is in need of repair. There are various different agencies, largely public agencies in the Western United States that are in charge of restoring these rangelands. One of the approaches I take is looking at restoration projects that these management agencies have undertaken, and basically retrospectively looking at how the restoration approach they used worked, right? How effective the restoration approaches were. And so this can entail looking at a collection of restoration projects and collecting data, or looking at the data they've already collected and assessing basically how the techniques they used worked. And then the other part of the restoration research that I do is trying to work with land managers to come up with new ideas. So these might be slightly riskier ideas that they're not quite ready to go out and apply over a large landscape because they're not sure if it's going to work or not. But by working with them, we can test them in smaller areas over shorter periods of time, with the idea that if it works, then there may be the potential of applying it over larger areas or of other people also using that approach.
Ideally, what does a successful rangeland restoration look like?
To determine if a restoration has been successful or not really depends on what the objectives were in the first place.
Okay.
And so, you know, the first step that a manager takes is to think about what their objectives are. In some cases, in a rangeland setting, it may simply be to just reestablish plants, right? So you don't end up losing your soil, so you don't end up with invasive species, and you end up with useful plants. So for instance, forage plants to be able to feed cattle. Another goal might be to establish wildlife habitat. When you're establishing wildlife habitat, there's a higher likelihood that you'll be interested in establishing native plants. Okay. And so that's often probably what people hear about, is the establishing native plants. A successful restoration really depends on what the initial objective was. But in general, it means trying to get some plant cover in there. And then in the areas where I work, usually it means trying to get in some sort of perennial plant cover.
So are there some restoration projects that you are involved with now on the Colorado Plateau?
my restoration work started based on people's interest in the Beef Basin area.
Yes.
So there have been these die-offs of sagebrush for many, many years. No one's quite sure exactly what's driven those die-offs. But what is clear is that the Division of Wildlife and the BLM have been interested in trying to reestablish sagebrush in those areas.
Okay.
So collaborators at the USGS and here at USU, and then also myself, we have had several different data sets that have pointed to the importance of soil properties in terms of how sagebrush do. So in particular, soil texture and depth. And in 2016, we got funding from the Division of Wildlife Resources to look at restoration of sagebrush in the Canyonlands Research Center area.
Okay.
In one of these projects, we actually planted out seedlings of sagebrush across a range of areas that had a range of soil textures and depths. And so soil texture and depth are going to be these gatekeepers of moisture for plants. Mm-hmm. And in these landscapes, plants really are going to be stressed and need, and moisture is going to be the number one thing that they're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
We published one paper on this looking at how sagebrush seedlings responded to soil texture and depth. And we found in general that these coarser or sandier soils tend to improve the performance of sagebrush seedlings. Another part of the project was to look at soil texture and depth across the study area. And so the idea is that if people who want to do restoration have access to these maps of soil texture and depth, they could look at areas that have these sandier soils and try to target those with the idea of maximizing success. The other part to that is, you know, once you get a sagebrush plant established as a seedling, you also need to look at how it will do over the long term. So thinking about its persistence over the long term. Yeah. So we also have collected some data on mature sagebrush performance across these different textures and depths. And so I have another grad student now who is looking at some of those data and actually looking at how mature sagebrush responded over a 6-year period that encompassed drought. And so we actually also looked at the effects of herbivory by looking in areas inside of exclosures where herbivores didn't have access and comparing those to areas outside of exclosures where herbivores had access. And so the idea is to say, okay, when the herbivores are present versus absent, how do these sagebrush persist over these 6 years that have been a drought period?
Okay. So you're trying to understand the best soil profile for sagebrush to grow in, but have the cattle being there for so long degraded? Are they responsible for the degradation in the soil profile?
That's a very good question. So cattle can, in fact, affect soil properties. And so one thing they can do is they can compact the soil. Their activity can lead to erosion or loss of soil. Mm-hmm. And in the Colorado Plateau, people often worry about the impacts they might have on biological soil crusts.
Yes.
However, for this project, for this restoration project, we're looking at soil texture and depth. And texture and depth are components of the soil that in our time frames are relatively static and are mm-hmm. not affected by grazing.
Okay, because you're looking deeper than what they would affect. Okay.
Well, and part of it is, so soil depth, right? That's just, you know, the depth at which you hit some sort of layer that restricts the flow of water.
Yeah, impermeable.
And then soil texture is just the relative proportion of sand, silt, and clay particles. Mm-hmm. And so sand, silt, and clay particles are just different sizes.
Yeah.
And so again, that's something that is you would not expect to be affected by cattle. Yeah. So what we're looking at is, you know, these fundamental soil properties and how sagebrush respond to those. But then you could imagine an added layer beyond that, which is what you were talking about with erosion or soil crust cover. Those might be additional factors that could influence how a plant might do when you're trying to restore it.
Yeah, you're making these maps of soil depth and texture that hopefully if restorationists can use to decide where to try to seed more sagebrush or whatever. So that's cool.
Yeah. I mean, and I should clarify, I'm not the one making the maps myself, but as part of the project, our project team made these maps and the idea is to be able to supply them. And we did actually give the data to the Division of Wildlife Resources. To what extent they're using them, I don't know.
You mentioned that the other part of your restoration research is trying to work with land managers to come up with new ideas. Here on the Colorado Plateau, you've been working with the Canyonlands Research Center at Dugout Ranch, trying to introduce new species of cattle that could possibly be more drought resistant and less harmful to the land, the Criollo cattle. Can you talk a bit about where that project is?
What we are doing is looking at the compatibility of Criollo cattle with the Colorado Plateau landscape. So Criollo cattle, they're a breed or they're a biotype of cattle, and they're actually a heritage breed. Heritage breeds have been relatively untouched by all of this artificial selection that these traditional cattle breeds have undergone. The way this happened is that they were in an isolated region of Mexico. And so they are a smaller animal. They're like 20% or more smaller than these traditional British breeds. And the idea is that they have literally a lighter footprint on the landscape. And also because they're desert adapted, there's a potential that they may have fewer impacts on the landscape. So the Jornada Experimental Range in New Mexico are the ones who first started working with these Criollo cattle and have been doing research on them for a while. And then Mike Dunaway, who's with the U.S. Geological Survey in Moab, began working with them. And then Matt Redd also was interested in these Criollo cattle. So they brought over a few of those cattle to the Dugout Ranch with the idea of testing to see how they would do. And so they put collars on these Criollo cattle and they compared how the Criollo cattle versus the traditional Red Angus breed moved and foraged across the landscape. In 2020, we formed a team to continue to look at how these Criollo versus Red Angus use the landscape. And so we got funding from the USDA to do this. This is a collaboration with people with a bunch of different expertise. So we have Mike Dunaway and Sasha Reed, who are at the USGS. And then we have a movement ecologist, Tal Avgar. And then we had Matt Garcia, who is a beef extension specialist. And then also Eric Thacker, who is a rangeland extension specialist here at USU. And of course, the star is the PhD student, Maria Stahl, who's working on the project. So we formed this team basically to compare animal movement and use of the landscape between the Criollo cattle and the Red Angus cattle. So we have about 20 of each breed that are collared with these GPS collars. And so they're continuously taking data. And so then we can then get the locations of these animals off of the collars and then analyze how they're using the landscape. So we can look at where they're foraging on the landscape, sort of what sort of ecological site type that they're using. And we can also look at behavioral things like looking at how much of their time they're spending grazing versus resting versus moving. And one thing that I should have mentioned is, so when I talk about these, about the Criollo cattle being desert adapted, one element is that they're smaller. And then another is that they've been shown to be able to roam farther from water, which is helpful in these really dry landscapes. Also, they in other areas have been shown to have broader diets. So that's going to mean that they have, you know, a different forage base available to them. And particularly important for the Colorado Plateau is that they tend to incorporate woody species into their diets more. Okay. So when we're thinking about climate adaptation and thinking, and you know, if you have drought or you have phenological limitations to the amount of grass that is available, which is what these red Angus are going to be relying on primarily, the idea is that the Criollo may be flexible enough to incorporate woody species into their diet, which are basically available year round and in even during drought times, whereas grass is not always going to be as available.
The grant kind of kicked in 2020 when you started assessing movements and everything. What have you seen in almost 3 years? Or is it too soon to tell?
It is. We are still in the more preliminary stages. So some of the preliminary results suggest that the Criollo and the Red Angus are both keying in on things like salt on the landscape. Like that's a major driver of how they're using the landscape. And that was it's both surprising and not surprising. I mean, it's not surprising because, you know, animals need that in these types of landscapes. It was a little bit surprising because we thought maybe we'd see some differences in how they were using the landscape. And just in general, so far, we've been a little bit surprised at how similarly they have been using the landscape. Matt Garcia, who's the beef extension specialist, has been less surprised by that because these Criollo animals are naive animals. They have not been in this Colorado plateau landscape for very long. Right. Whereas producers here, what they've been doing either just intuitively or because someone like a beef extension specialist is suggesting they do it, is selecting over time for animals that do best on the Colorado plateau landscape. So over, you know, decades, they're selecting for the best animals or the animals that perform best in these landscapes. So in some ways we're comparing these red Angus animals that are a traditional breed, but they have been selected for this Colorado plateau landscape against this desert adapted breed, but they're much newer to the landscape. So far they have been behaving a little more similarly than we had expected, but most of our analyses so far have been limited to a single time of year. What we're doing right now is expanding our analyses into different areas of the landscape and different times of the year. And so what we're expecting to see is that at different times of the year, the foraging behavior and the movement patterns of these animals may diverge a bit.
And you mentioned branching out to different times of the year to observe. I mean, what other observations are you attempting to make in the next few years?
One thing we're doing is trying to take a good hard look at what it is that they're eating. And so it's not super simple to figure out what animals are eating, especially when they're roaming out on the range far from people. One option is to actually have a human on horseback observing what the animals are eating and sort of what their behaviors are. We are hoping to be able to do that here in the next year or so. But other ways to get at diet are to actually collect fecal samples, and then we can send those away for metabarcoding. The people who do the metabarcoding look at the DNA of the plants that are in the fecal samples, and they can identify those plants and send us back a list of which plant species are being consumed. And so the idea there is that, you know, we can actually look to see, okay, even outside of this window of time when we're able to directly observe the animal, potentially from horseback, are the Criollo eating more of these woody species?
Ultimately, if you see positive results and the Criollo or the Criollo hybrid seems to be the way to go on an arid landscape, I mean, is the goal to go out and educate or try to convince ranchers on a wider scale that to adopt these?
If it turns out that Criollo look like a promising strategy for ranchers on the Colorado Plateau, the first step would be to show people this, because seeing is believing. It's risky to try something new if you haven't seen it be successful. So the Nature Conservancy and Dugout Ranch, they do field days. Already, the Dugout Ranch and Nature Conservancy have invited people in the area to come learn about the Criollo research that's been going on. And then, as I mentioned before, two of the people working on this project are extension professors. So one of the reasons that we have extension professors is because they are the ones who are much more closely connected with the ranchers or livestock producers. And so one of their skills and one of the things they do well is give workshops, create fact sheets that can be read by lay people. You know, another more practical concern that will be kind of intermediate between us hopefully learning that Criollo are promising and then people adopting it is making sure that Criollo are actually available to
right.
be purchased. And that's a whole other potential challenge to be overcome.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the hope is that if there were demand and interest, that might drive a greater availability of Criollo for people to incorporate into their herds.
I really appreciate you talking with Science Moab, and hopefully we'll talk again in a few years and see what's different.
Yeah. Yep. It'd be great to talk to you again.
To learn more or listen to other Science Moab episodes, visit sciencemoab.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Our theme music is by Jeremy Spaulding, and the show is produced by Peggy Hodgkins and KZMU. If you love Science Moab, support us by sponsoring the podcast, writing us into your research grant, or donating at sciencemoab.org. This programming is unique to Moab, Utah, and your support makes it possible.